listening to the most original talk radio station anywhere. We are LA Talk Radio at latalkradio.com.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolli right here on LA Talk Radio.
Thank you, Mr. Radio Announcer Voice, but you're only half right today because we are sans Sterling. Mr. Michael Sterling is unwell. He is less than stellar. He is, frankly, he sounds like Brenda Vaccaro after a carton of Luckies. He does not sound good.
But he's not drunk.
He's not drunk.
Despite the rumors.
He's not drunk. Despite the rumors, he is not inebriated. He is merely ill.
He's a little tarnished.
Sterling, yes. The Sterling is slightly tarnished.
Wow.
There's a little bit of it. Very
it's
good.
It's going to be like that,
I'm writing that down. Before we start, we'd like to thank our sponsor, Breakdown Services, the entertainment industry standard used around the world, providing the most professional means to reach talent agents as well as actors when casting a project. To learn more about Breakdown Services, please visit BreakdownExpress.com. And we'd also like to acknowledge PerformingArtsLive.com, one of the Internet's most prominent listing sources for the live arts in Southern California. We're grateful to them for lending their support to our weekly live arts calendar. Joining us in studio, she is a Grammy-nominated recording artist, best known to audiences as one of TV's favorite moms, Marcia Owens, the mom on the long-running ABC comedy Mr. Belvedere. She made her professional Broadway debut years earlier on the musical stage in Promises, Promises, the Neil Simon Bacharach David hit, where she understudied the leading lady and sang backups from the orchestra pit. She's here to talk about how that early experience came full circle at a performance this past week. Please welcome Eileen Graff. She's here. Yeah, and you did the Queen Wave.
I'm doing the Queen Wave.
Which isn't nearly as effective on radio, but I certainly appreciate it.
Well, you know, you always have to play to your live audience in the studio because it really gets the energy going.
Yeah.
Even if they can't see you, they can hear it in your voice.
They can.
When you're bored.
Yeah. And I appreciate you bringing the busload of people with you. I think that it's very good to really just prepare that way.
You're welcome. You're welcome. I think it's important to do your homework, and it's important to be a team member, to pitch in, to make every experience the best.
There you go. And the dual Queen Wave, too. I've never seen that. I've never seen both hands at the same time.
Well, you know, ambidextrous.
And you're jacked up on all that sugar from the butterscotch.
Oh, the
right.
Butterscotch.
Well, I guess that's the most polite way to put it. Also joining us in studio, he attended New York University's Tisch School of the Arts. You got to let me know if I get these right. The Nikitsky Gates Theater in Moscow.
Pretty
is that
good.
Right? And the National Academy for Theater and Film Arts in Sofia, Bulgaria. Really?
Mm-hmm.
He has produced, directed, written, and or acted in over 100 stage productions in New York, California, and Eastern Europe, and has recently become one of LA's most outspoken theater critics. He's a floor wax. He's a dessert topping. Jason Rohr is with us. Thank you, Jason. How are you?
I'm good.
Yeah.
I'm sorry I couldn't bring a busload of fanatics.
Oh, you can. It's just that easy. Yes.
Now you and I know.
Actually, you know what?
Borrowed Eileen's.
Knowing Jason as little as I do, I know he'll dig this. Check this out. You ready for this? And he's a floor wax. He's a dessert topping. Jason Rohr is with us. Better?
I like a power chord.
Yeah, did you?
Yeah.
Okay, I thought you would enjoy
that. Big fan.
Okay, so we were talking, you said something about your cell phone as soon as you walked in. You said you were insisting that you wouldn't...
It was expensive.
Shut it off?
I don't turn them off.
Right?
Yeah.
Are you a Zap junkie, Eileen? Do you like the gadgets? Do you have a cell phone? Is it just functional for you? Do you embrace all of the functionality of it? Where are you on that scale?
Strongly in the middle. I'm a
militantly apathetic.
I am militantly in the middle.
Yeah.
I love my Droid. I have a Droid. I don't have an iPhone. And I just love it. I don't do lots of things on it. I don't have to. I don't have that kind of a life. But, it's like once you go forward, you can't go back.
Yes.
In many phases of life.
And you become fairly reliant on it.
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I lost mine last week. And it was like losing my thumbs. It was very, very difficult to be without it. I lost my iPhone. I don't know if I lost it or it got stolen, but I had to replace it. But now they have the new... Is it an iPhone that you have?
It's a BlackBerry.
Okay, so does it have the similar voice recognition thing where you can talk to it and tell it what to do? like the iPhone has?
It tells me what to do.
Does it really?
I don't know.
I thought that was kind of, it was very unnerving to watch in the lobby, though, because you were just sitting there going, I know. What's that old Woody Allen line? I have a tape recorder, and when I talk to it, it says, I know. I'm going to steal. I'll steal from the best. No, it has this thing now called Siri, and you talk to it, and she's turned me into a half-wit, because it doesn't fully recognize the natural pronunciation of names. So you actually find yourself relearning your own family members' names by mispronouncing them. Jason Rarar. I'm in my car, guy. Call Jason Rarar.
My friend Joey just got his new iPhone, and he was driving me to lunch, mm-hmm. and he said, watch this. Siri, how do I get to Vitello's or whatever it was? Right. And she said, hang up the phone, you're driving.
Really?
Almost. It was something like, she could. The phone has gimbals in it. It can tell when you're driving.
What's a gimbal?
It's not Macy's.
It's like
no.
Where's the rim shot?
I've heard.
I brought my rim shot.
I'm sorry. It's not Macy's. Good night, everybody.
Thank you. I'm so old that I remember gimbals.
I remember gimbals. That's what I thought it was too. What is the?
Isn't that a thing in a gyroscope? I'm talking over my head. I don't know.
No, but I know that. Right. I know the term. It's like a little.
It's a thing that helps you keep your balance. And when you turn your iPhone sideways, right. There's a reason that the screen pans with you.
Right. It's a little gyroscope thing. Yeah. Okay.
So they know when you're sleeping, they know when you're awake. Mm-hmm.
They do. And they also, they have these built-in things, too. Like if you say, I could turn mine on and do it. But you, if you say, I love you to the Siri, it says, I bet you say that to all your mobile devices. Or, you know, there's about half a dozen things. Right. It's sort of the equivalent of the pulling the string. Remember how you used to have the dolls that you would pull the string?
Like Chatty Cathy. Yeah.
Like Chatty Cathy, right. Yes. Or
G.I. Joe.
Or Jim, huh? You were a boy.
Right.
You
briefly.
Are a boy.
Briefly.
But you were an affluent boy if you could afford the talking G.I. Joe. Mine barely had hair.
I stole mine.
Did you?
Yeah. And he did have mange. The hair rubbed off really quickly.
That's right.
Yeah, you the little,
mange.
The brush cut right. thing. Yeah. But mine had a beard that was painted.
Yes. And mine was the first to really look like one of the village people. It's like, this is...
Dun, dun, dun.
This is G.I. Joseph. Just the full name.
Was there really a talking G.I. Joe?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, he said, go over there or go blow up... that.
But see, oddly enough, my G.I. Joe would say, don't ask, don't tell. It depends on what year you bought it.
It's not that odd.
There was and the Kung Fu Grip. Did you have the one with the Kung Fu Grip?
No.
That was huge.
No.
The G.I. Joe, because,
no.
You know, remember in the 70s when Kung Fu was everything? It was like Kung Fu fruit roll-ups.
Yes.
Everything was Kung Fu. And, so I got the G.I. Joe with the Kung Fu Grip. That was huge.
Did that make you happy?
It did, because, you know, I have this whole thing about... I did this one-man show for years called Straight Up with a Twist, and the whole...
I've never heard you speak of that.
Really? Oh, geez, something in my eye. Oh, there's your queen wave right there. Obscene gesture in the studio. You never heard me talk about that. What's 10 minutes into the show? This is when I talk about it. At 12 minutes, we talk about my next project, but in 10 minutes, we talk about me riding my laurels. And it was about being a kid who was sort of misfit and perceived a certain way because of his certain affectations. So, yes, I not only had the G.I. Joe, but he had the best pressed uniform out there, spit shine shoes. But let us get to our guests rather than me chatting about myself. Our first guest played Sandy for two.
I have a shtick to read. But what's the point of having your
read the card, Eileen. Read the card.
What's the point of having your own show if you can't talk about yourself?
That's true.
What's the point?
It's okay. I have the 9 websites for that. Yes. Yeah, PaulStrolley.com, .net, .org, all things Strolley. I miss Michael. I miss Michael's voice. I miss Michael's reprimanding voice. Oh, Paul, stop. Stop talking about yourself.
That sounds like something the G.I. Joe would say. Paul, stop.
Yeah.
Nobody pulls Michael's string.
Right.
Michael comes out with his own pronouncement.
What would the Michael Sterling doll say? That's a good question.
How's my hair? This jacket goes, doesn't it?
I know it's odd to wear a smoking jacket in July, but this really brings out my eyes.
And it does. That's
it does.
Thing.
No, and it works perfectly.
It
yeah, he is truly one of the most well put together guys I've ever
yeah.
seen.
Yeah, that's true.
He really is.
That's
Michael,
true.
This is for you. If you're listening at home through your sneezes, we appreciate
it.
We
think you're well composed.
You are well composed. Can I go back to your intro now?
Yes, you
okay.
may.
Okay. Our first guest played Sandy for 2 years in the Broadway production of Grease, but her biggest Broadway triumph was creating the role of Cleo in the Cy Coleman Michael Stewart musical comedy hit I Love My Wife, directed by Tony Award winner Jean Sachs. She can be heard on the show's original cast album, and her other theater credits include Charlie's Aunt with Charles Grodin. Looking forward to talking about him. Cabaret as Sally Bowles, Annie Get Your Gun as Annie Oakley, and Over Here, directed by Mr. Belvedere himself, Christopher Hewitt, along with far too many credits to list here. She recently delighted audience performing in Critzerland at the Gardenia. We are happy to have such an elegant and talented lady back with us here at State of the Arts. Please welcome Eileen Graff. Now, we have all sorts of these audience sounds, so because Michael is not here,
yeah.
I'm going to add sounds as though he's here. So pay no attention if during the course of the thing, there we go. Yeah. So if you just happen to hear a little bit.
Isn't there supposed to be a little button in radio stations that you push in case you have to sneeze or something that you can push the button?
Yes, there is, and here's ours.
Oh,
I'm sorry, that was actually... Oh, jeez. I didn't know, it just kept repeating.
I think they
I'm sorry.
Had to take that button away from Paul.
Oh,
yes.
Paul.
I just... You don't want to have this electronic stuff in front
for
of
a show with Paul as the host, yeah. If you had that button, you'd just press it all the time.
Yes, exactly. It would be taped down. Yes. The
It would be a very quiet show.
Yes, it would. Yes, it would.
Mercifully. So...
So, Eileen, tell me about Mike. We were talking outside before we came in about Critzerland at the Gardenia, which is more Michael's speed than mine. Can you give us a little, for the listeners, a little synopsis of what it is? It's the record
sure.
company. It was Critzerland was a recording company that
yeah.
a particular style
it's a
of
label.
Music.
It's a label.
It's a label. Okay.
Bruce Kimmel, who is a music executive and a former actor, and he produces albums. He does a lot of different things. And he's got a wonderful web series now called Out of the Box, which is hilarious, and I recommend it. These little 6-minute episodes featuring Broadway stars who are invited to be in preposterous musicals.
Oh,
and it's
wow.
very funny. It's very satirical, and that's one of Bruce's latest projects. It's just great.
Like parodies of existing
parodies,
musicals?
Right.
Okay.
So, for example, my daughter was just in one for Bruce, co-starring with Brad Oscar, who is a huge Broadway star, and it was it's Bruce's voice on the phone calling a Broadway star saying, well, don't you want to be in my new musical, and it's going to star you, and he's very funny. And then it turns out to be a musical of Psycho.
No. Oh, okay.
So they're stabbing and blood spatter, and it's very funny.
So they get them on the hook and then just
and
sort
then,
of...
Yes, because
okay.
actors' egos are so gigantic that no matter what you offer, no matter how bizarre or hideous, if you say, I did this just for you...
Right, right, right. Exactly.
I'm there.
Exactly, yeah.
So that's one of Bruce's projects. And once a month at the Gardenia... He has a cabaret evening called Critzerland at the Gardenia. His record label is Critzerland. And it features a different songwriter or a different theme every month. And this month was his holiday production.
Okay.
And it was delightful. And I got to be a part of it this month and had just a wonderful time.
And it's an interesting history. The other women that you were performing with, I mentioned Promises in the intro there, and you performed with, what's the backstory on that? It was two other women that you were pit singers with in Promises.
Well, Promises was a groundbreaker at the time. Burt Bacharach and Hal David, who wrote the lyrics and Burt, who wrote the music, wanted the show to sound like a Bacharach David record. So
okay.
it was the first pit that was essentially covered. All the instruments were mic'd, and there were backup singers like there were on any Bacharach David record.
Very lush, full sound.
Great big orchestra and four singers, and that was our job, was to sit in the pit as if we were musicians and sing the backups to the show. And there's a lot of backup singing in the show. And I was, there were four singers. I was a replacement. I wasn't there from the beginning. But I also understudied the leading lady. So it was a great first job. It was right out of college. I got to be an understudy.
Wow.
I got to be in the orchestra pit. I got to see how everything worked in a show. I got the respect of the band as a musician, which you don't often get when you're an actor or singer.
Right, right. Yeah.
And I got to be in the show from time to time as well. And it was a great easing into that responsibility. So the three of the original pit singers and me as a replacement were invited to participate in this Christmas cabaret where we sang a song, one of the more popular, I'm not sure why, songs from Promises is called Turkey Lurkey Time. But it was famous because it was a fabulous dance number on stage that featured Donna McKechnie.
Oh, okay.
And it's all over the web. I mean, you can just watch it constantly now, but it was a great number, and the singers were featured because they're all dancing like crazy on stage, so they couldn't sing this song. So Bruce thought it would be fun for us to get together and do Turkey Lurkey Time, three of the original singers and me, and we did. We sang it. We sang our harmonies. It was so much fun.
Oh, that's great.
It was just a wonderful evening.
And you say this is a monthly series that he does there?
Yeah, and actually, he's going to be moving it to Michael Sterling.
To Sterling's upstairs
at Vitello's, because he wanted to be able to do it on weekends, because he likes having young people involved too. He likes it to be a family-friendly experience, and the kids can't go midweek because of school or whatever.
Oh, okay.
It's usually a Wednesday night thing, but he's going to move it to the weekend, like to a Saturday night, I think, a Friday night or a Saturday night, so that people can bring their kids.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, it's so much fun.
Now, and you've performed at Sterling's, right?
I have.
Matter of fact, you were talking about that the last time you were with us, right?
I have. It was a couple of years ago. We did two nights right over the holidays, in fact.
Yeah. Oh, okay. Yeah. Yeah. I love that room.
It's a nice
I love room. The Sterling. And you've seen shows there, Jason.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
I've never been. I've heard wonderful things about the Gardenia, but I've never seen any shows there. But there was a jazz singer named Sylvia Brooks, I believe, who she performed at Sterling's and also at the Gardenia. Mm-hmm. But they speak very highly about both rooms.
Yeah.
I'd like to see something over there.
The Gardenia is probably the longest surviving cabaret restaurant
place
I know
there's
in
a
town.
Tremendous history there. I want to go back to something that you said earlier when you were talking about working on Promises and the understudy thing and the preparation for that. I always think, whenever I hear about someone understudying, I never have, and whenever I hear about an understudy role, I always think, being a fairly nervous person myself, of the performance anxiety associated with being an understudy, and especially in a show where the role is played by a name, and then you have to step in, and you have that immediate prove yourself thing. That must have been a wonderful ease into it, to be so familiar with the material, to be in the pit and actually, I mean, you had to just be chomping at the bit to get up on stage to do it.
I guess I was. I was so young. I was literally like a month out of college. And youth is a wonderful thing, because you don't know what you're getting yourself into.
Yeah.
You just sort of do what they tell you to do, especially if you're still in a student mentality.
Yeah.
We had a brilliant stage manager who was legendary in New York, named Charlie Blackwell, who ran our understudy rehearsals. He went on to write the book for a very successful musical called Tap Dance Kid. And Charlie just always, we had weekly understudy rehearsals, full-blown, full-out understudy rehearsals, so that when I finally got to be in the show, and I didn't know literally until half hour that day. I had just eaten a tuna fish sandwich for lunch.
Ouch.
And they come downstairs and they say, oh, you're on. And I went, okay, let's go. Called my mom and dad. I'm going to be on. They flew in from Queens to come see me on the show. And you can't make it from my house into the city in a half hour, but they did. And I just sort of went on. And I apparently did really well, because I remember I sang my big song, Knowing When to Leave. And the audience just kept clapping and clapping and clapping. And I'm like saying, oh, isn't this great? You know, just so naive.
Great.
But I didn't have the nerves because I didn't know enough.
Right.
I think if I were in that position, I would be a little more on edge.
That's true. That's true. You know, I never had any sort of performance anxiety or stage fright when I was younger. It was just, and it wasn't until I got older, there's sort of like where you think about the possibilities. Or maybe it's just the history of performing and having things happen and having things go south that you realize the likelihood of them. We're going to talk at the end of the hour. What we always like to talk about is a mishap that you've either of you have had on stage or performing, because I know, Jason, you did a lot of performing as well. And I'm always intrigued at hearing those tales. Cause,
you should worry now. When you were younger, I'm sure it was different.
You're saying that my fear is now justified. The fear of failure is probably...
You've lived long enough, I think, to justify... Just about anything.
Well, you know, in order to get back to the whole one-man show that I never talk about.
I was wondering.
It had been 10 minutes.
Is this
Read the card! Read the card, Jason! Every 10 minutes, straight up with a twist. Everything. No, all kidding aside, the reason I wrote it was because I started to suffer from incapacitating stage fright.
And if only it had taken.
If only it had taken. What we would have saved the theater-going community from. It was very difficult, very unnerving. And it's like, well, how do you stare this down? Well, you do the most frightening thing you could do,
right,
which is autobiographical. Boy, you want to keep someone away from the theater in droves? Say autobiographical one-man show. Yeah, and then you get the people who actually see it, and it's good, and they go, hey, it didn't suck.
Right, right.
It's like, well, thanks. How do you respond to that? We were also talking before we came in, Eileen, about some of the people that you work with. I know Jason brought up Charles Grodin, but we both brought up Rodney Dangerfield, who you did Ladybugs with.
Yeah.
And I was just curious if you could inform us a little in terms of, there's all these stories about what a loose cannon that Rodney was and if what he was sort of like as a person. I know, hearing through comics, that he was probably the most supportive entity for young comics that was out there. The regard in which they hold him is just like mythical. Mm. So I'm just curious what it was like just working in a film scenario with him, not a nightclub scenario, what it was like and what he was like as a person.
I can't say that he was a loose cannon at all.
No.
When, as you know, when you shoot a film...
That's not the story we wanted.
I know. I feel bad. I feel bad. I wish I could tell you, like, wacky things about Rodney. But it's
hookers and blow, yeah.
Yeah. It's something that people should know, that when you're on a set, as you know, it's business.
Yeah.
There's too much money and too many people that are waiting around, that when you're on a film set, you're doing the film.
Yeah.
I'm sure, you know, we all know stories about people that get crazy and hold production up, but I think that that's far less common than the other side, which is, this is our profession, this is what we do. Rodney was very quiet and serious and really funny and really fast. And there would be scenes where the director or the other people, mostly it would be the director and the producer, would be standing around and say, we need something funnier here. And he would shoot off 5-10 jokes, like machine gun fire. And you'd go, oh my God, I'm witnessing Rodney do what he does.
What he does, yeah.
And it was very exciting to be in that process.
And that's not a young man at that point.
No, he was in his, I think he was in his early 70s when we did the movie. I think he was like 72 or 73 when we did the movie. Mm. And he was just so fast. And there would be times, you know, as you know, on a set where you have time when you're sitting around doing nothing and it's too far to go back to the trailer or to go back to base camp or whatever, and you just have to sit and wait, and if you didn't bring your book. So I would sit next to him and I would say, okay, so tell me a story. Tell me about when you sold storm windows. Mm-hmm. And he was always more than willing to comply, as most comedians are very happy to talk about themselves. But for me, who didn't, I mean, I knew him. I certainly knew Rodney Dangerfield, was aware of his work. But there's something about hearing that stuff right from the guy with those blue eyes and about his life and how the jokes all have a basis in reality, that humor comes from pain. and what an unhappy guy he was, and how he brilliantly turned it into this mammoth career.
Yeah, and was Jack Roy, was that the stage?
That's right.
Is the name
Jackie
he
Roy.
Used?
Yeah.
Jack Roy,
uh-huh.
Yeah. Now, just you mentioned just him firing off the jokes, and I think that's one of the reasons that I dug him so much. He really is the last of the great joke men, because, you know, the way he was a lot of people don't know, he was a contemporary of Lenny Bruce's.
Yep.
He was performing the same time as Lenny Bruce. There's a great shot of the only two people in the shot are, aside from the cop who's arresting Lenny Bruce, is, you could see George Carlin in the background, famous photo. But Dangerfield was there that night too, as Jack Roy, or so I'm told, or Jackie Roy. And I don't think people realize, you know, that he came from that, and then to totally redefine himself later on. It's almost like what Leslie Nielsen did late in his career, mm-hmm. where it's just sort of like, you know, he was so associated with this young, and then reintroduced himself to this whole younger audience, mm-hmm. and did it well, did it by recreating himself rather than, you know, resting on his laurels, you know?
Yeah, and they were very devoted. I mean, Rodney's fans are just so devoted. And as you say, the young comedians are still to this day, comedians will always want to talk to me about Rodney, about what was Rodney like, and I'm so sorry I never got to know him, and all of this stuff. And I think it's really pretty cool, because show business is not famous for the loyalty of fans or people having respect for their elders. That's not the thing that we do best.
Right.
And to feel that warmth that people have towards him, I think is really cool.
Yeah, and I agree 100%. It's just the word play. It was smart. It was smart silly. Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of like the Monty Python thing. To be that silly, there has to be a whole lot of smart behind it.
Absolutely.
And that's what it was. It's almost like Steve Martin was in the late 70s. I mean, the only two comics that I can think of, and we're about the same age, is
no,
the,
we're not.
What?
No.
I didn't mean emotionally. but quoting lines from comedy albums. You quote lines, the Steve mm-hmm. Martin lines, mm-hmm. you quote the Dangerfield lines, because the wordplay is just so tight, and it's so honed perfectly. But mm-hmm. I'm glad to hear that he is that was a craftsman like that.
Oh, 'cause totally.
That holds him up. I have to do a little arts calendar here, and then we'll chat with Jason immediately after that, if you while we pay the bills here. Unless you'd like to read it, Jason, you want to read it?
I bet he's a really good reader.
I bet he is.
Because he's got a beautiful speaking voice.
He does. It's much closer
gorgeous.
To Sterling than mine.
Gorgeous.
Why don't you do our live arts calendar there? Go ahead. Just start right there, and you can do Michael's job today. Actually, would you read the live arts calendar as though you're Michael? That would be great. So start there and end there. Yeah.
Paul. The Alliance Repertory Company presents a special one-night-only production of The Eight. Reindeer Monologues, tomorrow evening, Tuesday, December 12th at
Wang Chica, wow,
Theater in Los Angeles. Playing last year to sellout shows, this electric, eclectic, eccentric theater company shares the story directly from the reindeer's mouths that Santa has been a very naughty boy this year. If you want edgy, frank, and nonstop hilarity, you wrote this, Paul. Don't miss the tale of what
right.
is really going on at the North Pole and how the jolly old elf has been misbehaving. This actually sounds really cool.
It is fun.
This irreverent look at the truth about the Christmas run is the perfect antidote for an often overly sweet time of the year. Boy, do I have something to say about that. For mature audiences only, for tickets, call Theater at 323-422-6636.
How's it going? It's electric. Electric, Jason. Absolutely.
I'm sorry,
incredible.
Michael.
Yeah. But you started out
I hope that doesn't
good.
Make you sicker.
You started out pretty good. Michael had was going to do a little review of the Kritzerland gig, which he said was just delightful. So all I can say about it is that I know his review is delightful, but he'll probably share it with the listeners next week.
Okay.
For further information about any productions and or events mentioned in today's State of the Arts calendar, brilliantly by our stunt Sterling, visit us at stateofthearts.la.com. We also suggest you drop in at performingartslive.com, where you can search for Southern California events that are happening in several different categories every day of the week. So, thank you so much for that. Appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Yeah, you enjoy it?
That's
you said you had something to say about that. We're talking about holiday things you
There's
read about.
There's a lot of garbage out there right now.
Oh.
To be seen.
You mean just in general or holiday themed
garbage?
There's
a lot of holiday trash being swept into the theaters at this time of year. I think a lot of I actually had an impresario, a very nice guy, and this is a theater company that I won't mention by name because they do a lot better work than this, I am told.
Okay.
I believe it. A lot of people who think very highly of these folks told me to go see some shows there, and apparently I saw the wrong two shows. But the impresario's excuse to me, in his defense of himself, and he very honestly said that there wasn't much of a defense. He said, we did 28 shows this year, and we got tired.
And he owned up to it.
Yeah.
Wow.
And I thought that was awesome of him.
Yeah.
And it certainly was my experience that there just was not a lot of investment put into these couple of shows. It was an 8 o'clock and a late night, both of them holiday themed, and both of them one of them the writing was really 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 weak, and but very well directed, and the other piece was very amateurish, very awkward performers in their street clothes standing in front of a curtain reciting.
Okay.
And I thought that was a little less than theatrical and a little less less than what I had wanted. And I offered him, since he had given me the tickets for free in order to write a review, I said, what if I don't write a really lousy review of your show? Can we call it even? And he said, yeah. So I thought that was nice. But this is the time of year where a lot of theater companies feel there are two pinches, I think, that people feel at this time of year. One of them is we got to get the kids in.
Right.
We got to make sure that there's something for little children to come and see, which is fine. But the other pinch, unfortunately, is, hey, you know what? It doesn't have to be very good because probably a bunch of little kids are going to come and see it.
Oh, right, right.
And the joke is that in the old Godzilla movies, you know, it's the little kid who's going to notice the wings, the wires
yes,
that are holding
yes.
Rodan into the air. Yeah. It's I think always a mistake to assume that because your audience is chronologically challenged, maybe that a younger audience isn't going to be sophisticated enough to see that you drop the ball.
Oh no, I used to do magic shows for kids' parties when I was in high school, mm-hmm. and they're the hardest people in the world to fool because they immediately, first of all, they're fearless. They don't,
yep.
they have no social,
yep. Yep.
you know. Oh no, it's right there, and they also automatically think logically and uncluttered.
Right.
They immediately think just no, it would make sense for there to be a string going in
yeah.
your sleeve and
yeah.
go down and they're usually right. And while you're, you know, trying to kick them into the closet.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to also point out that for every example of what you're talking about, Eileen brought up, I don't know, were we on the air yet when we were talking about the El Portal thing?
No.
Because I've heard only good things about, and just to evidence a child's or something that is child friendly but also very well executed, the Cinderella at the El Portal, the British panto,
right.
that you said was just a joy.
Well, actually, Snow White was the first one that they did, and I think Snow White runs another few days, and the next show they're going to do is Cinderella. Now, these
okay.
are produced by the Lithgow family,
okay.
and they yeah. are this Snow White was first class. Michael Orland was
yeah.
the musical director, and everybody in America knows Michael. He's one of the piano players and coaches on American Idol.
Right.
And he's a darling friend and so serious about his music with the biggest smile on his face. And the Eric Bergen is one of the stars, and Eric was in Jersey Boys for a long, long time.
Eric was here 2 weeks ago,
and
yeah.
And he's a doll, and he sings like an angel, and
yeah.
he's just the nicest guy. And then there's...
Funny man.
He's
very funny.
Funny.
Yeah. Wow.
And there's a young lady who was on the Glee project, which I guess was a reality series about
mm-hmm.
getting a guest spot on Glee. This Lindsay Pierce, I think her name was. She's the another one of the stars. Well, I didn't really quite know what to expect. And I was so pleasantly surprised. I laughed and laughed. It's so funny. The costumes are beautiful. It's funny. There's stuff for the grown-ups. There's stuff for the kids. It's energetic. And what more do you...
Now, had you seen Panto before?
Uh-uh.
Okay, so, I mean, that was something I became... We had a, sort of a theater junket when I was in college. We went to London, and we saw 15 plays in 14 days.
Oh,
and one
paradise.
Of them was a Panto of Pinocchio.
Uh-huh.
And it's the cheering the villain, yes, or cheering the hero and, yes, booing the villain. It's almost, it's like interactive, it's like music hall interactive. Yes. It sounds great. I want to catch it before it goes. I want to also give Jason his formal introduction, because we never got to give you the proper lead in that you so rightly deserve. We could always ask Michael to read it. Michael, would you mind? No, okay, then we won't do that.
Don't get up.
He has acted and written for all media, radio drama, stage plays, feature film, episodic television. He was head writer and performed on the topical theatrical review Live Live News News, ran for 3 years, playing regularly at the Comedy Store and other Los Angeles venues before embarking on a successful tour. His many other responsibilities now include being a theater critic for StageHappenings.com and writing commentary on all things theatrical at BitterLemons.com, where he's also an administrator. Please welcome Jason Rohr. I'm curious. I'm curious about the pronunciation, because I'm a huge Tom Lehrer fan. Do you know Tom Lehrer?
Yeah.
Do you follow Tom Lehrer? And I know that he has the same sort of thing where it's H-R-E-R.
Yeah.
And I always said Tom Lehrer. And I heard him say his own name in a recording.
How does he say it?
Lehrer.
Okay.
Yeah. So is yours Rohrer?
No.
No.
No, we, I'm sure, mispronounce it.
Unless you're speaking into the Siri, then you have to say rrr. Yeah. How do you say it?
I'll tell you a funny story. I don't know. We pronounce it with one syllable, as if it is the sound coming out of the mouth of a large animal.
Okay. Okay.
We probably are wrong about that. We don't know much. The roars. The true story. My grandpa and grandma went to Europe.
Is this another grandma and grandpa story?
Yeah, but this isn't dirty like that.
Oh, okay, good. Because you sent me those pictures. That was very unsettling.
Grandma and Grandpa Rohr went to Europe on a bus tour sometime in... And this is about as culturally... this is the apex of our cultural evolution as a family, that we returned at some point to our point of origin. And they were on a bus, and they were driving around, and they got to Switzerland... And the tour guide said, listen, you know, Mr. and Mrs. Rohr, not on this bus tour, but just over that hill, there's the town of Rohr, where no doubt you have some relatives, and probably you could find out something about where you came from and what your whole purpose on life, purpose on earth is. You could rent a car. You could rent a car and a driver for about $15, drive over this hill. We will meet you on the other side of the hill with the bus in about 8 hours, and you could spend some time in... no, thanks. No, we're going to stick with the program. And they did. And so I don't know to this day, and it's his fault.
There's actually a castle there, yeah. The Castle Rohr.
Yeah.
And they're searching for a descendant. Apparently there's an inheritance that they want.
That sounds like a Rodney movie.
Oh, yeah, it does. No, thanks. We're fine. We just want to stay on the bus, eat our cheese nips. And
Rohrs are comfortable on buses, preferably in the back, preferably asleep. I took a really good bus tour of Bulgaria once, because I was spending some time there. And
is there a really good bus tour of Bulgaria?
There really is. Yeah. It depends on the number of bottles of wine that you procure right before you get on the bus.
Okay.
And the bus driver, it was a very convenient thing for the male members of the party, that the bus driver would open the flapping back doors of the bus to allow us some relief.
From
the massive amounts of wine that we were drinking.
Oh, nice.
But
nice.
The girls had no such luck, and they declined to come on the next tour.
There's an image. There's really an image. Open back door of the bus.
It's radio. that's the gift.
And now the dreams are going to start again. So now I'm curious about something.
Yeah.
How does the Rohr family go from performing to... I mean, obviously you were writing already, but what made you want to review? Or is it just sort of an evolution?
I had nothing left. There was
nothing left.
I slapped a casting director and yelled at another one.
Oh,
in
really?
2000.
That was you?
6. Yeah, you're welcome, by the way. All performers owe me a debt of gratitude, because I'm the one who took that bullet.
Yeah,
and said, you know,
you physically slapped a casting director.
A casting assistant, yeah. There was a guy who it's not really as amusing a story.
Is this a true story?
Yeah. And that
was roars, I'm telling you.
My acting career was such at the time that my options were try desperately to find another agent after that one says, you know, you're not supposed to hit casting agent, casting assistants after I send you out to that audition, or give up about $250 a year in residuals. So
I'm sorry. I have to interject a Dangerfield line here.
I don't want to be a member of any club.
No, no. That's Groucho.
Sorry.
That's
Groucho. One of my favorite Dangerfield lines is, I left show business for a while. I quit. And to give you an idea how well I was doing when I quit, I was the only one who knew I quit. Just like, if that's what you're reminded me of.
So. No, my mother knew I quit because all of a sudden she was paying my rent.
Oh.
Yeah. The joke of the whole thing was that I don't think I was supposed to be auditioning.
Okay.
I think that that I'm just supposed to get work. So since since the... I'm sorry, Paul. You all right?
It's okay.
You're gonna need another screen.
Thank you. No, and I got green tea in my more than ample nose. Thank you.
My work ethic now consists of getting up in the morning and looking at the phone and saying, whatever. Because I used to care a lot more.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
But yeah, I was forced through necessity to take some anger management classes and which I didn't.
We all
didn't
see how that turned out.
I didn't. I didn't actually do it. But
do they give a class on how to not urinate off the back of a bus? Is that available?
I'm real good at that.
Are you?
I didn't need any.
You didn't need
that.
Any classes.
No.
On that. Yeah.
But I did slap the back of the driver's head once when he stopped too quickly. Nobody's luggage appreciated that one either. But the career trajectory since I'm not acting very much. My acting was such that it was okay with pretty much everybody that I stopped acting. it wasn't all that much to write home about,
right,
although
right.
I wrote home about
There's
it.
There's no one wringing their hands at that, the loss of your presence on the boards?
Not so much.
But how do you find your way from being on stage to writing about the shows? How
bitterness.
Bitterness.
Bitterness and revenge, I think, are my primary motivations now.
But you mentioned something earlier that I'm happy that you talk about, because I do think that there is a tremendous wealth of good theater in Los Angeles. There's also a tremendous amount of crap.
Yeah, but the there's so much good stuff that... there's more theater here than there is in New York. There's more theater here than there is in Chicago. There's more theater here, primarily because there's... there are more unemployed actors.
Right.
It's actor-driven here.
Yeah,
right, right.
Yeah, and unfortunately, L.A. gets the rap of being, theater-wise, a sort of layover for television work, mm-hmm. for film work.
Or always a springboard. Theater's always a springboard.
Yeah, there's the what Tony Franco calls the... sorry, Tony. That's not how Tony says it.
No.
He doesn't forget what he's saying in the movie.
Is he drunk too?
Yeah. Yeah, he is, actually. But that everything's a sort of a showcase.
Right.
It's,
oh, yeah.
The showcase syndrome is that I'll go to see a show and it's presented as, hey, it's Sweet Charity, for instance, which went up recently. And Michael actually reviewed, I thought, very kindly. A production of Sweet Charity that went up a few weeks ago.
Yeah.
And was clearly... A gambit to get somebody into the spotlight who may deserve it, but probably not in that particular role. It was a really unfortunate choice for everybody. But the joke was that it wasn't a show so much as it was a showcase.
Right.
I see very little of that in town. There's a significant amount, sure, but you can mostly tell by the advertising when that's happening.
Well, that's just it. Do you see less of it because it's not there, or do you see less of it because you can discern it through the promotional material that's going
to
be the case?
To a certain extent.
And you make your choice.
Yeah, but I don't think that, if 1,200 shows go up in a year in L.A., which is roughly it, I don't think 200 of them are pure showcases.
Right.
In the 90s, they would present themselves as such.
Right.
This is an actor industry showcase. This is I took part in one, really, unfortunately, that was for recent graduates of NYU and recent. We stretched the concept. There were.
Right. I think I saw that.
Some
two guys sitting
walkers.
Around slapping casting directors. Is that one?
Essentially, yeah. We were not asked to return. But the Most of the theater that I see is earnest, and most of it is not a way station. Most of it is not somebody waiting to in between gigs.
It's also the other thing I always like to recognize about it out here is that it's the most difficult town to get people to theater to.
It is.
Because you have to drive everywhere, yep. And it's not like New York or Chicago. Well, we'll meet at the restaurant, and we'll take a cab over to there. And, you know, at the end of the work week, getting back in that car to go out to theater is really, you have to really relish the audiences for that. I'm sorry to cut you off.
No, you're right. And that's one of the challenges. Another one is rent. For producers, another one is the number of actors who, if they're really good, they might get snapped up. They might have to leave the run and go do a commercial or something that pays, because most of the theater in Los Angeles does not pay.
No.
Vast majority of shows here don't pay. That doesn't necessarily lower the quality of the productions, I don't think. It lowers the necessary devotion.
Yeah, it lowers the lowers the likelihood of retaining good people if something else comes along and in 1 week you can make what you would have made.
Yeah, and you can't expect. I mean, I get irritated when a producer, whether it's a play or a pilot or whatever, and it's happened to me for TV shows as well, pilots and whatever, where they really expect the actors to subsidize their project.
That's right.
Yeah. It's your project. If you can't afford to do it, don't do it. Mm-hmm. I don't see why I have to subsidize your idea.
Yeah.
I have enough of my own cockamamie ideas that cost me money.
Yep.
I don't know why I have to do your cockamamie idea, too.
Yeah.
You don't earn my loyalty just because you love your project so much.
That's right. And a lot of,
that's a great way to put it.
A lot of impresarios and producers will tell you that because they have a part for you, and a lot of actors will believe it, because they have a part for you, then that you should be grateful and give of yourself and sometimes of your wallet to the production. And this is a pay-to-play town. There, you know, if you want to play the Roxy, you got to sell some tickets.
Yes.
And that's the way it works here. And that's okay. If everybody understands that that's the way it works. But that means that the product is likely to be a lot more commercial, and a lot the production will be driven by marketing and a desire to make its money back rather than an attempt to create some art.
But rarely do we go and see something just because we want to see it. We mostly go see things because we know somebody involved we want to support them.
Yeah.
I mean, if a big show comes through that we want to see, we'll go see it. But it's not every day that I'll go look through the listings and say, oh, I really need to see this show that's playing on Santa Monica Boulevard in a 30-seat house. I don't need to see that. If I have a friend who's in it, of course I'll go. And I find that most audiences are filled with your friends.
Yep.
When getting back to cabaret, it's the same thing with cabaret, where rarely will you be in an audience to go see somebody who's really, really good. And it really, as you say, it often has nothing to do with how good it is or good the performer is. But it's not something that everybody wants to go see. And in a way, you know, people say, well, we can't let this die. We can't let this die. Well, maybe we have to. I mean, there's no more vaudeville either.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe there are some things that, not that they deserve to die, but we can't be, you know, wringing our hands and be all upset because we don't support theater. I don't see that we're not supporting theater. We're supporting our friends.
Well, I'm sorry. No. It's also, we're up against that, too. Those of us that are producing, like my company, Seaglass Theater, we produce every year, and we always put forth a good show, a good product, and we're up against this stigma, too, of the friends and family theater. And we're not that. Now, of course, we're all reliant on that in the earlier stages, because before the reviews hit and before the press goes, you go there. But when you're trying to do 6 to 8 weeks of a run and you get that word of mouth going, that's what we're up against. We're up against that showcase mentality.
Yeah, that's right.
Right. You know. The showcase mentality is a really good way to put it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Because we think everything is just a showcase, whether it deserves that title or not. And some showcases are fabulous. I mean, there are some actor friends I have that I would go anywhere to see them in anything because they're that good. I just want to be in the room with them.
But there's no, because there's a cancer in the system doesn't mean necessarily that the system is going to die.
Right.
And I think that the fact that this town and every theater town I've lived in, every town I've visited, there's a substantial portion of the material that's crap, and that is
it's
being foisted upon the public specifically to further somebody's personal interests or you know, financial or otherwise, and that's true. There's a lot of that, but there's also a whole lot of really good theater, and that's why I think that as our understanding of some of the new technologies evolves, we'll see new kinds of theater showing up, and already there's a way that I became involved within the last year or so with a website called Bitter Lemons, and one of the things that this website does is it will let you know which of the shows that that you want to see is in fact going to be a showcase piece of crap, and which is actually a real show. What the website does is it collates various reviews, and it'll in the manner of a Rotten Tomatoes, for instance, right. And it'll let you know how various points of view have reflected on this show. That kind of a thing will, I think, and is already killing, but it will kill a substantial portion of the mold that's growing on the body theatrical. And I think that the more that we allow that to happen, the more that we allow some sunlight into the thing, and stop letting it be a very intimate incestuous community.
Incestuous.
Yeah.
Oh,
yeah.
Absolutely.
Case in point, I wrote in a column for Bitter Lemons recently that our spelling. This is a minor thing, but it speaks to a larger issue. The way that we spell theater in this country is incorrect, and we spell it with an R-E on the end. Precisely because we think it's so damn precious what we do. It's such our little in joke, you know, and you almost can't find a theater building that's not named
R-E.
Theater R.E.
Yeah.
And a theater company almost always, yours included, Paul, has...
I always thought theater, E.R. was the building and R.E. was the art form.
Yeah, no. Okay. you can look it up. I didn't make that stuff up. But when we get less precious about it, then we will become, I think, better artists and more inclusive of the kind of audiences we want, because...
Stop handling it so delicately.
Yeah, yeah. Musicals and gay theater are not going to solve the whole thing for us. No. We need to invite everybody back into the theater.
I think that's a good point to end on. And actually, we have to end, because we're at 50 minutes, and we have ended our hour. Didn't that go fast?
Wow.
Yeah. So we have to have both of you back so you can share your nightmare on stage stories.
Okay.
Come back.
Will you?
Yeah, I'll come back. But only
Eileen,
if Michael's
you come
here.
Back again?
I'll come back.
Only if Michael's here.
I mean,
thank you.
You know, I just want the both of you. Okay. This is, you're great. But chocolate without peanut butter.
I know. No, that's it. That's it. Almond joy. Thank you both. Pleasure having
thank
both
you.
Of you on. And Michael, get better soon, and we will
please.
Both be here next week. Thank you, and we'll see you next week on the radio.
You're listening to State of the Arts with Michael Sterling and Paul Strolley right here on LA Talk Radio.